All right, good evening, everybody. Good to see you all. Hope everybody's doing well today. We continue going through 1 Corinthians in our study of the epistles. We're in chapters 10 and 11 tonight. And as usual, a lot of material to cover in 40 minutes of time. So we'll jump right into it. I hope everybody is being able to take the things that we're learning and apply them as you think about your lessons for next quarter. This section in 1 Corinthians 10, really, it's in the middle of this second half of the book where we're dealing with what we call common concerns. We sort of carried chapter 10 over into this section, but it really kind of belongs in a lot of ways connected to chapters 8 and 9, where the topic is idolatry. And 8, 9, and 10 really go together as one topically, because that's really what's being dealt with. We'll look at that here. In this chapter, Paul is dealing with the question of the meat offered to idols. He started with that in chapter 8 and verse 1. He dealt with it directly. You remember chapter 9, a lot of that was a personal example of how he was willing to give up his right for the benefit of others, and sort of illustrating how they should be willing to give up their right to eat meat for the benefit of others. And then he gets back on it in chapter 10. So it's just a continuation of all of that same argumentation. So we start in chapter 10 and verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So the experience of the Israelites as they were delivered from Egypt is paralleled to the experience of Christians, and particularly to the experience of the Corinthian Christians. I want you to think about this. The Israelites left a land of idolatry only to be tempted to idolatry and fall victim to being idolaters. And there's a lot of parallel in that with what the Corinthians are about to go through. They escaped the bondage of idolatry, and now they're being tempted to get back into it. And I think that's sort of unspoken, but spoken too. It's parallel in all of this. So he says, you know, both we and Israelites are sort of baptized into a leader. They were baptized in the Moses, in the cloud, and the sea. So they're basically immersed in following him is the metaphor. And we are immersed in following Christ. And Moses, God through Moses provided for their sustenance. God through Christ provides for our sustenance. But with them, God was not well pleased. Their bodies fell in the wilderness. And the parallel is plain. Just because you've escaped the bondage of the world doesn't mean that you've got your ticket punched. You've got to, you know, be aware of temptation. And that's where he goes with all of this. Yes?
Verse 4, Christ's existence in the Old Testament.
Yes. I think, although this is quite symbolic language that he's using, I do believe that this is one of several places you go to show Christ in the Old Testament. That's a valuable lesson, I think. But he says, these things are our examples. These things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. So he's going to list several things. Do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. And in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now you're all aware that each one of those warnings refers to a specific Old Testament event. And each one of those refers to a fairly amazing story that in and of itself, each lesson in and of itself would be profitable. Lusting as they lusted probably refers to the craving of meat that occurred in Numbers chapter 11. The becoming idolaters is an obvious reference to the golden calf incident. They sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. committing sexual immorality with the Moabite women, you might remember, in Baal-Peor in Numbers chapter 25, and then tempting Christ in their discouragement when they were nearing Edom in Numbers chapter 21, the five in that story, and then complain as they complained were destroyed by the destroyer. That's in Numbers 14. The destroyer seems to represent, just in passing, I'll say this, a reference to what is elsewhere called the angel of death, the plague of death at the birth of the firstborn, the death of the firstborn, the tenth plague. That angel is also referred to as the destroyer. And so you have those who were just destroyed by the destroyer in Numbers 15, death itself, if you will. So you have all of those examples, and what is really being said here, these people escaped this bondage and were following the Lord's prophet, and yet they all fell away and tempted and lost what they'd hoped in through temptation. And so you come to verse 12, and it says, and we quote this verse all the time, "Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Well, that's applicable to all of us all the time. But in the context, you know, he started out in chapter 8 talking about people that thought they knew things and could handle certain things, right? He says, knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And so this prideful, I can handle this, it's not going to be a problem for me sort of situation relative to idolatry is kind of the ground of everything that he's saying here. He says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So overconfidence in dealing with temptation is dangerous, any temptation. But on the other hand, God will provide a way of escape that you might be able to bear. There's a great promise. Both of those verses, 12 and 13, are just such helpful, fundamental promises to us. One's a warning, one's a promise, that help us in dealing with temptation, which is what they need. Because is he going to show them, they're being tempted more than they think they are with this eating meat sacrificed to idols thing, and more than he's led on to this point. Y'all agree? Because it didn't seem like in chapter 8 that it was that big a deal. Right? But here we're going to see it's bigger than they all thought it was. Okay? So he says, therefore, flee from idolatry. And when you have a therefore in this kind of position, verse 14, that's the punchline of the previous 13 verses. He said all of that to say, flee from idolatry. Here you're and may not realize it. 14 is the connector to all of that. And then he says, I speak to wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. This is a bit of a tactic that Paul uses with the Corinthians, a couple of other places as well. We'll see it in chapter 11, where he says, look, you guys can think for yourselves. Here's some reasons. You just reason this out for yourself. What about this, this, and this? Now what do you think? You know? And so he lays it out for them logically and expects them to draw their own conclusion, which, you know, they ought to be able to do. So he says, I speak to wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say. So here's he lists three things. When we partake of the Lord's Supper, do we not commune with Christ? Everybody say, well, sure. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not a communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not a communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread, one body, for we all partake of that one bread. So in eating this meal, we are participating together in Christ. That would be something that they understood to be true. Oh yeah, I see that. Okay. Next thing, as flesh, are not those who eat the sacrifices of the altar. So the Israelites who eat the sacrifices are worshiping the same God, participating in the same sacrifice, part of the same religion, right? They would all be going, yeah, we see that. And so then the third, the you know, punch line to that is what he says in verse 19. what am I saying? That an idol is anything, or that or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God, and I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You see how he just sort of led him down the garden path there? When we partake of the table, we're fellowshipping Christ and one another. When Israel partakes of their sacrifices, they're fellowshipping, you know, with God and their religion and with one another. And when you partake of the meat sacrificed to idols as such, you're participating in that idolatry. And the idol is not anything. He's already said that. It's not a real God. But behind the idol and the false teaching that, you know, surrounds it, and the false religion around it, that comes from demons. And so you're fellowshipping demons, in essence, when you eat. And so that, all of a sudden, this takes this whole thing to a whole different level, doesn't it? I hope you're following that. Let me see if I can get to my notes where I am. So he says, you cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. That's the problem. You are, by a very clever temptation of Satan, on the verge of engaging again in idolatry. That's his warning to them. Now, I want to lay out then based on all this reasoning, and again, he's been really reasoning this for three chapters. Some of it's kind of subtle, but it's all of this has been about this question about meat sacrificed to idols. And how do you treat one another? How do you relate to the meat? And what are you supposed to do or not do? So he's going to kind of then lay out the rules that he's established. He could have started just by saying, well, here's what the rules are. But he didn't. He reasoned through it with them for these three chapters. So here are conclusions concerning things offered to idols. The first thing is in verse 23, something that he pretty much said in chapter 8 as well. Some things that are lawful are not helpful or edifying. So just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Remember us saying that in chapter 8. So some things that are lawful are not helpful or edifying. You could do it, technically, but it's not a good thing to do for the sake of your brother, for your conscience, or whatever it is. He says, secondly, don't seek your own well-being, but the well-being of others. Look at verse 24. It just lays that out. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. And then he says, when it comes to eating the meat sacrificed to idols, look at verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake. All right, so first thing is, eat whatever is sold in the meat market. So here's meat you don't know for sure where it came from. Could well have been sacrificed to an idol, but you don't know. So you're eating it not knowing that it was sacrificed to an idol. He goes on, he repeats a little bit that he said in chapter 8, the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. In other words, it's food. It was intended for food. There's nothing wrong with food. And you know, he's established that already. If any of those who do not believe invite you to dinner, you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no questions for conscience sake. So again, you go to somebody who's an unbeliever, he may be an idolatry, he set something before you, it could have been sacrificed to idols, but you don't know that. He didn't say anything. So just eat it. It's food. What he says. But if you are informed that this was offered to idols, then that changes the game. That changes everything. Do not eat for the sake of the one who told you and for the conscience of the other. See what he says? But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat of it for the sake of the one who told you. So somebody's telling you that, and they're telling you that for a reason. Either they are an idolater and they want you to participate in idolatry with them in saying, hey, this was offered to our idol, you know, this is extra good that way or something. Or they might be telling you, this was offered to an idol, and maybe you know, because you're a Christian, maybe you don't want to take it. Whatever the reason is, you're now informed that this was offered to an idol, and you know that it was meat sacrificed to an idol. So he says, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why Okay, let me stop there. Conscience, not your own, but that of the other. It's not that you're violating your conscience. Remember, you know that meat is meat, right? But this person has consciousness of the idol as he's eating. He's eating it as something that's been sacrificed to an idol. And once you know that it's been sacrificed to an idol, if you eat it, you also might involve yourself in that consciousness of the sin. So the thing is, the other person's conscience isn't making this determination for you. He says, why am I judged by another man's conscience? And the implication is I'm not. I'm making a determination as to what I'm going to do based on what is good for that person, good for me, and good for all. I believe that's, and I know that this phraseology is very hard to get a bead on, and just a few commentaries and we'll see that, but I think that's where he's going with it. So he says, if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of the food over which I give thanks? You know, it's food. It's not that it's meat. Whatever the meat is, that's inconsequential. That's not the point. The point is that when you realize it's been sacrificed to an idol, then you involve yourself in participating in something. See, it's in the mind, right? Eating a lamb is eating a lamb, right? But if that lamb has been sacrificed to God at the Passover, then that has a whole new significance, doesn't it? And we understand that it's the intent of that sacrifice and your knowledge of that intent that makes that meat special. The grape juice and unleavened bread is grape juice and unleavened bread until you eat it at the communion, right? And meat sacrificed to an idol is just meat sacrificed to an idol until you know it's been sacrificed to an idol. And that's in your head. So that's the point of all that. And I think the bottom line is, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. It's all for God's sake. It's with you or whatever. And don't give anybody offense. Give no offense either to the Jews or the Greeks or the Church of God. I want to talk a little bit about offense. The word offense does not mean hurt somebody's feelings. It never means that in Scripture. It means to cause to or to tend to cause somebody to sin, to present a stumbling block before somebody else in what you're doing. Now, let me just say this. There are times when you do the right thing and the thing that you must do, you're going to offend somebody. Because you're going to make them mad with the truth, and they're going to do sinful things, for instance, and say and think sinful things because you said the truth. So you cannot always avoid offending people, even in the sense of making them sin. Jesus didn't. You might remember more than one occasion he offended the scribes and Pharisees. His disciples even asked him, do you not know the Pharisees were offended at what you said? They were caused to sin. But any time we can avoid that without sacrificing truth, without sacrificing right or wrong, we should avoid it, obviously. And so that's the thing he's saying. Don't cause people to sin, whether they're Jews or the Greeks or the Church of God. Do whatever you can do not to cause people to sin, short of sacrificing truth. And then he uses verse 33 again, himself as an example, just as I please all men and all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many that they may be saved. So give no offense, don't seek your own profit, but the profit of the many. All right, that's a chapter. 20 minutes, we got 20 more minutes, we got another chapter. Y'all have any quick questions?
All the points you made, though, it didn't change the fact that the brother who knows, who has the knowledge, that it's just eating meat. Nothing's changed for him, but it's all for the benefit of the other person.
Right.
That's the whole
that fact doesn't change. But it starts again with that first thing he said. We have knowledge, but knowledge puffs up. Love edifies. Follow love. Don't just because you know, you think you know better than somebody else, or maybe you do know better than somebody else, but follow what love would have you do. That's kind of the point. All right. This next section, the first half of chapter 11, is honoring headship. I kind of preached this as a sermon a couple of 3 weeks ago, so I won't get as deep into the weeds in it as I did in the sermon, but we're going to go through this quickly. And some of you may have some input that you want to offer here as well. Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. I think that mainly adheres to what he's just said. Probably belongs in chapter 10 more than chapter 11. But it also sort of forward into what he's going to say. As we talked about, you know, in the lesson the other day, we're to be followers. Paul wants us to be a followers of him as he follows Christ. And in this context, that would include his willingness to forego his rights and his privileges for the welfare of others. But it's also going to apply to what is about to be discussed regarding headship. Notice that Paul praises the Corinthians. He says, I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I gave them to you. He praises them in keeping the traditions. The word tradition means something handed down. If it's an apostolic tradition, it's handed down from God to Christ, to the Holy Spirit, to the apostles, and the apostles handed it down to us. That's an inspired tradition. And so apostolic traditions must be kept. Human traditions are worthless, but apostolic traditions are authoritative, and they must be kept. And so he's praising them for that. There is this order of headship. I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. All of this relates to the concept of submission, where one is ranked under another. The word submit or subject really means to be ranked under. Hupotasso is the word. And you have this ranking of order of headship or authority that God has established from the beginning. And so based on that order of headship, he says, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. Every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, for that is one and the same as if she were shaved. So it's opposite for men and women. As I said in the sermon the other day, the way you define praying and prophesying here will determine a lot of what your outcome is, how you think this should apply. But I think the fairest way to apply praying is just communicating with God. And the fairest way to define prophesying is inspired speaking for God. Now, there are times when you could use an inspired gift to pray. You could pray in a tongue, for instance. We know that. We'll learn that over in chapter 14. You could prophesy and it not necessarily be inspired. There are a couple of instances where that word is used that way in Scripture. But both of those uses are very, very exceptional. And so the common thing that praying means is praying to God. Prophesying means speaking through inspiration from God. Communication to, communication from. And that's why headship is of special importance when praying or prophesying, because it's up and down. See, you got your heads are above and you got the up and down direction of the communication, and that's where headship comes into that, I believe. We notice in chapter 11 and verse 5, every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It's the one and the same as if her head were shaved. A woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. Shorn or shaved, let her be covered. I understand, you know, there's, you know, at the end of this text that her hair is given her for a covering, and that related to what's being said here in verse 6, I believe that what Paul is saying is that it's recognized that a woman, when she's shaved, is dishonoring her head, and also if she's shorn, both of those would be the same, cut or shaved. And so if that's recognized, then that she needs to be covered. Of course, there are those who say, well, that's the whole thing is just talking about the hair. So, but that's, I think you all understand what I think about that. Seven, to say, a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and God, but woman is the glory of man. Man is not from woman, but woman from man, nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. There's some great teaching in this section, aside from our application of the covering, which we have difficulty, you know, coming to terms with in unity. But I do think, as you're teaching this, even to little kids, that the concept of headship, of, you know, man and woman being interdependent, but also there's still headship there, that the man is the head of the woman, and that flows from creation. If you ask, well, where do men come from? Well, you'd say, well, they're all born from women. But really, woman came from the man, you know, from the beginning of creation. And those kinds of things are the things Paul's alluding to as he talks about the reasons that headship is the way that it is, other than the fact that God ordained it. So in verse 10, he says, for this reason, the reason of ordination, the reason of headship from the beginning, for this woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. So the covering is that symbol of authority, respect of authority, respect of the one who's over her in some sense. Nevertheless, neither is the man independent of woman, nor the woman independent of man in the Lord. For as woman came from man, even so man also comes through woman, but all things are from God. So again, this woman comes from man comes from woman, and so there's an interdependency in all of this. The order of headship does not alter the mutual dependence of man and woman. He says this is done because of the angels, and as I said when I preached on this a few weeks ago, I really don't know what that means. So there's a suggestion angels have interest in the natural order of things, and the natural order of things does reflect this headship, and so they're interested in seeing that that's done as God created it to be done. Other than that, I don't know. I went through that really quickly to this point. Does anybody have a comment or thought to this point you'd like to add? Or question? All right. So finish this up. And then he makes this argument starting in verse 13. And here's me, again, this interesting way he does things. He kind of laid out ready for what he said about women being covered and men being uncovered when praying or prophesying. He's already laid out those reasons. But then he says, judge among yourselves. In other words, okay, look, I'm going to give you some reasons, you decide. You know, you think through this. And he asks rhetorically, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? So that's kind of the question. He says, does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? If a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. So, again, I believe nature there in the sense of how God created the natural world to be. And I don't know if that's the best way to say it or not. I understand the word nature can mean other things, but I think preponderantly, it means something that God ordered by in physical creation. For instance, the natural use of women, Romans 1 and verse 26, men left the natural use of women to do abominable things, men with men. So there's a thing that God created as far as the sexes is concerned. That's a natural order of things, natural, how God created it to be. And doing something other than that, homosexuality, is unnatural. In that sense, that's the kind of same way I think he's using it here. Although, you know, I understand sometimes it can refer to something that becomes a certain way because of long habit. So that can be thrown in here as well. But the main thing I want to make note of is that whatever nature teaches, and what Paul says is, nature teaches this. Nature itself teaches you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him. If a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her. Her hair is given her for a covering. But in verse 13, he uses the word proper. Is it proper for a woman? So nature teaches us what is proper. And the word proper there means fitting and right. Here's what's appropriate. Here's what's fitting and right. And we're taught this by nature. So the argument is, you can just look at nature and see that women ought to be covered and men uncovered because you can see their hair. And that ought to teach you that. I think that's the argument. So nature teaches that the woman's hair is given her for a covering. If anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom in the churches of God. I think the custom there, it would be the custom of being argumentative about this. I pointed out in the sermon that I preached that look at the different translations if you're looking at that sometime. Several different translations and kind of try to put them all together to come up with what's really being said there. I don't think any one translation really gets it. It's really hard to translate it. All right, questions or thoughts? Anybody want to add on to that? What's a good way to approach this for your classes next quarter? Anybody have? Mm-hmm. Wow, y'all are so talkative tonight.
Wouldn't it be good to start with verse 16? I
don't know. Start there and back up? Yeah, having that before you, before. And you know, here you got the same two chapters to teach that I've got in this lesson. You're going to have to pick out which big rocks you want out of this. You're not going to be able to teach through these 16 verses, especially most of your kids, this will be a first exposure to all of this. You're not going to be able to do that. So you're going to have to pick out the big thing that you want to get out of it. And like I said, I think it's headship. Yeah, and if you get that, you can get that all the way down to the little kids. And if some of the older ones have some questions, you might want to do a little discussion on or something. But I think that's the big rock I'd take. All right, the Lord's Supper. Obviously, that I was talking to a brother here not long ago. Well, as a result of preaching that lesson, you know, we use 1 Corinthians 11, 17, then all the time, almost every week before the Lord's Supper, because we take the Lord's Supper every week. We study 1 Corinthians 11, 1 through 16, maybe once every 6 years or something, you know. So this is kind of weird. In the same chapter, you have something we look at all the time and something we look at not so much time. And I think it has to do with partly because of the controversy, but also, you know, the limited application in the sense of it. But anyway, we know these verses, and that's good because I don't really have time for them to do them justice. Verse 2, Paul had praised the Corinthians for keeping the traditions that he delivered to them. Now he says, in giving you these instructions, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. They were coming together for the worse. And without reading every word of this, the worse was when they came together, there was divisions among them. Paul says, you know, sometimes you got to have divisions so the people who are doing the right thing can be made known, maybe made manifested. But he says, you've got divisions among you. Secondly, they were taking their own supper. They were doing it selfishly. They weren't even sharing with poor people. They had no concern for those who had nothing, and that's, you know, you're coming together, not, that's not edifying. That's driving wedges and causing problems when you do that sort of thing. And you're eating common meals should be done in your own house. They're coming together as a church, not even time to do that. That's not what the church is about. That's not why we come together. Okay? So they're coming together, and it's for the worse. I would note with you that five times in this chapter, from verse 17 to the end of the chapter, the phrase come together and come together as a church. The Lord's Supper is to be done when the church comes together. And that's just it's stated, as I said, five times in this text. And to me, that's one of the real clear things that comes out of this. Paul down some things to them from the Lord. I delivered unto you that which the Lord, remember that? Delivered unto me. What did we just say something handed down was? Tradition. Here's an apostolic tradition. He says, I gave you this tradition, but I'm not praising you in this because you didn't keep this tradition. I praised you for keeping the other, but I'm not praising you for keeping this one. So he says in verse 23 exactly that. I received from the Lord that which I delivered to you. So that's the handing down. That the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it, said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken. You do this in remembrance of me. And the same man also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he come. These are really well-known verses that are on our hearts. But they were partaking in an unworthy manner. And I think that's chiefly what he was describing in the earlier verses. When they were taking their own supper, they were making a meal out of it, they weren't even sharing that, they weren't discerning the Lord's body, they were not making any distinction, let me put it this way, they were not making any distinction between a common meal and eating the Lord's Supper. And when we don't make that distinction, we make the same terrible mistake they did. There must be a distinction between eating a common meal and taking the Lord's Supper. You must discern the Lord's body. That's what it means, discern, to make a distinction. Discern the Lord's body. What you're doing. So when you come together to eat, he says, wait for one another. If you're hungry, do what? Eat at home. You want a common meal? Do it someplace else. That's not what the church comes together for. That's so plain, isn't it? Why do we have churches coming together to eat common meals? You know, that's their work. I don't know. That doesn't make sense. All right. So, key concepts, quickly, the Israelites in the wilderness serve as examples for us regarding the disastrous consequences of not taking temptation seriously. God will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear. He'll make the way of escape. We should seek the well-being of others, not our own. Do all to the glory of God. God's ordained headship, submission, which must be honored. Covering the head while praying and prophesying honors the head of the woman, but dishonors the head of man. The Lord's Supper is to be taken in a worthy manner when the church comes together. All right. Any other comments or thoughts? I know that's an awful lot, and a lot of it's pretty deep stuff, but I appreciate y'all. And again, I admire you who are taking on this challenge of trying to get the big rocks out of this to share with our young people and at least get them some rudimentary knowledge of what the epistles are all about. So that's the challenge that's before us. And if I can help at all, let me know. We've got three chapters. Whew. Sunday morning. All right. 3 and 12, 13, and 14. Big chapters too. So have fun getting ready for that.